nobody wants to be rushed to hospital as an emergency, but for those who are also cancer patients, the prospect of going to A&E for urgent care is particularly daunting and often leads to admission. We're about to hear how changes have been made in Cheshire and Merseyside to reduce the number of cancer patients presenting in emergency departments, while also developing safe alternatives. I'm Caroline Kenyon, and this is the Health Innovation North West Coast podcast. Hello, and welcome to the Health Innovation North West Coast podcast studio.
Hi.
Hello. Hiya.
Great to see you all. Thanks for coming into our offices in SciTech Daresreed. First, some introductions. Would you like to go around the table and introduce yourselves? Mel, do you want to start?
Yes. So I'm Mel Warwick. I'm Head of Transformation at Clatterbridge Cancer Centre.
Hi. It's Ernie Marshall. I'm a medical oncologist at the Clatterbridge Cancer Centre and clinical lead for our Urgent Cancer Care Programme Board, which is a piece of work that's been running across Cheshire and Merseyside.
Hi, I'm Ragit Varia. I'm a consultant in acute medicine at Mersey and West Lancashire NHS Trust and the Trust same-day emergency care lead.
Brilliant. And I've got three of the best people here to talk about a system-wide programme of improvement that's aimed at improving things for cancer patients when they need urgent care. And the emphasis, as I understand it, is on keeping them out of hospital, or at the very least, minimising their stay in hospital. But I think, first of all, we should hear why this is so important. So why would you say that this is needed?
Perhaps I'll take that. I think I'm the oldest in the group. Acute oncology services have been around since 2009. They were kind of recommended to roll out across the country for all hospitals with an A&E department. And pre-COVID, so probably 2018, 2019, which was approaching a 10-year anniversary, we started to reflect that acute oncology services had stalled somewhat. There's quite a lot of variation and almost a sense they were a little bit out of step with some of the pressures happening in urgent care, some of the pressures on A&E. And so we had an opportunity through some of the national networks to do a bit of commissioned work with Matt Millen, Cancer Charity, to do a much more focused look at that kind of urgent cancer journey from patients from their home through community into the hospital. And that project, the North Mersey project, as it was called, was the first time we were able to sort of systematically look at patient journeys and identify some of the themes, the activity. And what really came out of that, the conclusions were that if you're a cancer patient, you're much more likely to be taken into hospital by an ambulance. And if you arrive in A&E, you're much more likely to be admitted into hospital. And there was this real sense that the urgent care system was not confident managing cancer patients. And although there'd been some progress inside hospitals, perhaps they'd been less joined up working across that kind of wider system. And really, it was that led us to sort of start conversations around why we might need this kind of concept of a more joined-up urgent cancer care board.
So what would you say, from a cancer patient's perspective, what would you say that felt like for them when they needed urgent care?
I think from my perspective, seeing patients who were having very good cancer care, then feeling quite vulnerable when they were in the position of ending up in unfamiliar surroundings, unexpected admissions, and sometimes expected admissions with unexpected long delays and journeys that could have been much better in terms of experience. I think talking to patients, it was also this feeling of who's actually in charge of my acute journey, because they knew who their oncologist was, they knew who their oncology teams were, but they didn't quite know who was going to take over their care when they were in that urgent care setting. So it was that sort of sense of vulnerability and feeling a little bit out of step, and also not knowing what the impact would be on further cancer care once they've had an acute admission. So I think, you know, that also for urgent care meant that we needed to do something for our patients who, as we had an increasing number of patients that were in the emergency departments waiting for longer periods, as we know, we needed to focus on our vulnerable cancer patients and work in step with our oncology teams to provide a rounded journey for that patient.
I must say, step in rugged, because it resonates with the project we did. There was a real sense from all the professionals we work with, as well as the patients, that A&E is just the wrong place to be if you're a cancer patient. Sometimes it's the right place, but for so many people, A&E just isn't the right place to be. And that was kind of the common message. And it's one of the areas we've got real traction with all the stakeholders, because as soon as they hear about the project, I think there's that real sense of ownership that actually we're all on that same journey of trying to get patients out of A&E.
So were medical staff putting off decisions because they had a fear of getting it wrong with someone who was receiving treatment for cancer? Is that what was happening?
Rugged?
I think, you know, from my perspective, people want to make sure that the patient gets the best. And therefore, it's about perceptions and it's about correcting those perceptions. And that's the journey that we're on together. I think there is a perception that sometimes it is easier to get the better care by admitting a patient. There is that perception that things will get done quicker because you are an inpatient, that you will be seen by specialists quicker, that you will have scans quicker, and that something that could potentially be missed when you're in your own home may not get missed. These are all perceptions, and I think, you know, it's about getting that journey with minimal inpatient attendance and potentially keeping patients out of hospital, and how we have those pathways built so that the patients have the best experience without coming into hospital.
And I do think as well, as an oncologist, it's evident there's a real dislocation in the system. It's not individual decision-making. Cancer patients have specialist treatment, tertiary centres, that's often, you know, distinct from their local hospital. And so local clinicians, ambulance drivers, GPs are often faced with a patient where they don't have access to the right information. They had a drug that's unpronounceable, and really they've got little option other than to move the patient to a safer place. So I think it's a system problem. It's not a problem based on the professionals.
Absolutely.
I think also as well, just to come in there, is that So the staff that work in the emergency departments, there is that, I think, that general fear around a lack of expertise and who to contact as well and at what time. So there's that sort of general fear there as well, I think. And I think that's getting better, but certainly a number of years ago that was quite prevalent.
So Mel, you came in as programme lead. Can you describe what you faced with, what the scope of the work was and how you set about it?
So obviously the scope of the work was huge, because it's, you know, across Cheshire and Mersey. We knew that there was pockets of lots of really good work happening across a number of organisations, really, as I say, across the region. We had acute oncology teams already that were fairly well established, but working in isolation, again, in organisations across Cheshire and Mersey. So we knew that there was lots of work going on, potential duplication in terms of service improvements and developments. So we wanted to bring that together into a central place where there was central expert oversight, really, and leadership around the direction of where those services should go, and how they should develop in the future. So we also have got other services. We knew we had sort of metastatic spinal cord compression service, and we had, you know, a service around cancer of unknown primary, metastatic disease as well, that we wanted to kind of, we knew there was developments going on, and we wanted to sort of spread that best practice. So that was the whole sort of ethos behind the programme, was to bring key people, key stakeholders together with that expertise to drive that forward and provide that leadership across the region.
So what did you do? What was the structure that you set up that enabled all this to happen?
So we basically sort of corralled the key stakeholders and the people who were experts and who were really keen and motivated to get this up and running, along with Ernie, who was really the driving force behind it all, and had been for a number of years. So we spoke to key people, you know, Rigit being another. We got some of the key leaders in the room and said this is something that we want to do in terms of setting up this programme across Cheshire and Mersey. We involved lots of disciplines as well. So, you know, there were senior managers involved, obviously clinicians driving it at the heart of it, really. Patients, GPs, you know, lots of others from primary care, acute trusts, So we got them all into a room together. We obviously, you know, set up some aims and objectives of the programme, what we wanted to deliver, and we just took it from there. So the first programme board that we held was in March 2021. And it's sort of it's grown legs, and it's sort of developed.
Yeah, I must say, Mel, I think it was akin to pushing on open doors. I think
it was.
It really did resonate with all those stakeholders, yeah, that there was a problem here and that we needed to come together. And it was after having those joined up conversations that, you know, the support of the Cancer Centre, the Cancer Alliance, and for the first time, I think, across the country, the cancer services leadership came together with the urgent and emergency care leadership. And it was that kind of coming together of those two discrete strategic kind of episodes across the NHS that really kind of galvanised the work.
And what triggered the work? Was there a meeting or a moment in which you agreed that this was what you're going to do?
I'm not sure there was one moment. I think there were lots of corridor conversations. There were lots of individuals who identified and recognised ongoing opportunity and work streams. And then it was really that opportunity of commencing a conversation through the Cancer Alliance that brought those various stakeholders together and allowed us to start to see those interdependencies. And whilst we're obviously managing the scope of the programme, the board, for the first time, brought all those disparate people together, and actually it's got a life of its own to some extent now. The ideas, the opportunity, the connections are there now, not necessarily building or investing in complete new projects, but aligning to what's already happening out there. Identifying opportunity and partnership working has really been the big success story, I think.
You mentioned some exemplars, Mel, and Mersey and West Lancs Teaching Hospitals was held up as a beacon of good practice. Rigit Vario, explain to us, what have you done there that's become a shining light for this programme?
I think we start in a good position. The Trust has been recognised for a number of years as an outstanding organisation that people want to work in. But it's really because people are ready to look at opportunities to innovate. And here was an opportunity to have emergent innovation. It was almost like that Dyson moment where you had a solution and you were looking for the problem and you knew the problem. So, you know, akin to that, you knew that there was same-day emergency care. You knew that there was solutions like virtual wards and hospital at home that were developing at the same time. And we were looking at what are the solutions, what are the problems we could use those solutions for. And I think a lot of this sometimes happens just by chance, that the dialogues are happening at the right time. Clearly, the pandemic had given us this shared sense of needing to do something. And that continues in the NHS with the pressures that we continue to face. So I think it was really about getting the right people at the right time in an organisation that was, as Ernie put it, keeping the doors open. So there was no pushing against doors, but an open environment to discuss and work together with the Cancer Alliance.
I think some of it's serendipity.
Yes,
as part of my role, I work at Mersey West Lancs Trust now on behalf of Clatterbridge Cancer Centre, and I bumped into Raggett and we were away.
One of those corridor meetings, no doubt, which can lead to great things. And the Innovation Agency has played its part, hasn't it, in helping bring this together and helping with the programme management. So I know that my colleagues are delighted that they've been working alongside you.
Yeah, and thanks for raising that, because one of the first partners we brought into the board was the Innovation Agency. And really, they opened our eyes to networking and opportunity. And from the outset, they identified a range of innovations that were already out there that we would not otherwise have known about in digital telehealth. We're now starting to use artificial intelligence in our hotline project work. And we've met a lot of new partners who otherwise wouldn't. So, yeah, Innovation Agency has been a key part of the conversation.
Thank you, Ernie. And we know that part of this work is enabling a choice for cancer patients so they don't always have to go to A&E. How have you done that, and what is the situation now?
Oh, I guess we could tackle this from all sorts of directions, can't we? Perhaps I'll start. A lot of cancer patients directed to A&E because there's no options. That was the problem we found. But we have an existing regional cancer helpline for patients on treatment, and those patients can phone for advice and we can help signpost them. Before the project work, we couldn't signpost them anywhere other than A&E or into our own specialist hospital. But through the kind of connections we've created, through the opportunity in same-day emergency care, we're now starting to discuss with patients options, including how we might direct them away from A&E into medical same-day emergency care facilities. We've got similar pathways now into urgent community response services. And I guess it's that central coordination and signposting to enable the patient to get to the right place first time has been really key to this.
Yeah, so like I was saying before, you know, same-day emergency care is a concept. I can define it as what NHS England calls it, where possible specialists are providing care on the same day of arrival, and it's an alternative to admission in the conventional sense. But really, for us, this is a mindset change. So it's about thinking what you can do in a way that provides an alternative. And this is only when it's safe to do so. So patients that need to remain in hospital will receive inpatient care. This isn't about moving everyone out of hospital. It's about making sure that we are picking the right patients and giving them the alternative and then providing them the support structure. So same-day emergency care needed to have access opened out to the cancer hotline to have those two-way discussions so that we could have clinician-to-clinician discussions. But then also that led to multiple pathways being developed for conditions that patients with cancer develop. And I think, you know, as that sort of progressed, we were then looking at what is the support structure that a patient needs when they're presented with a cancer emergency. And that's where, as the virtual wards, which were allowing the patient to be in the comfort of their own home, whether that's a care home or a nursing home as well, it was then how we use telemedicine and how we use sort of technology to support hospital at home. And that's where obviously the community care elements come in as well. So this isn't just joining up cancer care and secondary care. It is about joining up the whole patient pathway. And I think Gurney mentioned UCR, and Mel's obviously been talking about this in the programme.
Yeah. So I think it's fair to say as well that a lot of the services that we now signpost patients to existing services, so they're not newly established services. They've actually been out there for some time. So, it, you know, from that point of view, in terms of tapping into existing resources, that's something that's obviously really beneficial, isn't it, for the system? You know, there's been some sort of additional education and training that's been required for some of this and some of the teams out there that are now seeing some of our patients. But on the whole, we're using existing resources, which is obviously, you know, which is the right thing to do as well.
You mentioned the hotline, which was existing, but presumably that's being used now differently in the same way that the community teams are.
Yes.
How have you enabled that to happen? Is it a case of training people?
It is, and there has been some additional support put in there. So we have had some additional resource, and again, you know, that has come from that has been supported by the Cheshire and Mersey Cancer Alliance via some national monies. Again, but it's minimal in terms of the support. So we've put additional support in there. It's worked really well. It has been a change in mindset, really, for the staff, and a change in how they work. But it's working really well. And we have got some other further developments in the pipeline as well, which are just about to start.
I think it's important to maybe highlight it's not just connecting systems. It's partnership working.
Yeah.
The hotline staff have been given the tools and the awareness to understand these systems exist, these services exist. But actually, they're now having one-to-one conversations with clinical colleagues in other hospitals, in the community, that the shared learning happening
and
between different disciplines.
Relationships, Ernie, as
building
well,
relationships.
I think, which is really important. Yeah.
Can you paint us a picture of an example of how this works in practice? So if you can describe a patient who's got cancer, develop something else, if you think of something that might prompt a need for emergency care, what might that look like? What sort of need might that be, and how might it be dealt with? If you can sort of describe an example for us.
I think we can go through multiple examples, but commonly patients with cancer, as a result of chemotherapy where their immune system is affected, you have the potential of a temperature, a simple temperature, being a cause for concern, because they can go from being quite well to being very unwell very quickly. And that's where historically this concern has built up to say, well, they've got a temperature, they need to be brought into hospital, we need to do everything and not take any risks. And this is where having the right education, the right conversations between clinicians, but also supporting that with pathways and the right processes, you will have such a patient now ringing the cancer hotline to say, I've effectively got a temperature. They will go through an effective triage process, at which point, instead of conveying them across to the emergency department, if there is a feeling that further investigations and examinations are required, then that can be done in a same-day emergency care or acute medical interface. Patient will therefore not be in that sort of environment that they are concerned and scared about and being vulnerable in the emergency department, be seen quite rapidly. And at that point, if there is a decision that, based on validated evidence-based scoring systems, you are safe to be discharged, then the next question becomes, once you're discharged, do I need to keep you on a virtual ward to make sure that you remain okay, to give you that backup with the historical anxiety, but also the clinical continuation of treatment? And then at that point, what will be happening is they will be receiving the kit to do their observations. They will have the questionnaires to answer the appropriate questions. Those clinicians will then be board rounding virtually and deciding what the care delivery needs to be. So you will, instead of being discharged, you will be onboarded onto a virtual interface, and you will still have the care that's needed till everyone feels that it's safe to discharge you.
And maybe a slightly different angle. Cancer is often associated with elderly patients. So an elderly patient lives alone. They have a pet dog. They've got some ill-defined tummy pain, a temperature maybe, or they've had a slight fall. Currently, they'd be racing into hospital. But with the conversation, we can now have a community team review them within a few hours of that call, and actually they just need support and a kind of wraparound service at home, which completely avoids the need to go near hospital.
And the dog gets looked after.
And the dog gets looked after, yeah.
That's great. So where are you up to now then with all these various work streams? Is it job done, or where are you up to, Mel?
No, not at all. So we've made some really good progress, and we've got some of these pathways really well embedded across the system. There's more to do, though. You know, we've got other community teams that we need to get on board. There's other pathways that we need to put in place. So we're just coming to the end. Well, we've just finished the end of our sort of second year of the urgent cancer care programme. We're just going into our third year. We've just managed to secure some additional funding to keep that going for another 12 months. You know, it's business as usual for us in some senses, but there's further work for us to do.
And are you at the stage where other systems around the country can learn from you, can copy what you've done, can pick up your templates and processes and apply them themselves?
I think we definitely are. I'm going to refer, though, to Ernie, because obviously Ernie's sort of involved nationally at a national level, so Ernie's probably knows a bit more about this than me.
I think all the pieces of the jigsaw are there. Many places have central hotlines. They have access to medical, same-day emergency care, community services. What they perhaps haven't done is had that structure and coordination to bring those stakeholders together. So I think our story can help others see the direction of travel, the ambition. But it needs time. It needs leadership. It needs those people to forge new relationships, which is difficult given all the pressures that they're under already, kind of managing, you know, immediate problems with urgent care and cancer priorities. But it's about trying to make those connections. I think we can share that message.
Is that the Cheshire and Mersey magic then, the connections that you've created?
I think so, that and the football teams.
I think we'll avoid football.
Yes.
So the vital ingredient then, leadership, collaboration, connections, is what you would say has the secret, if you like, behind making it all work. How does it feel for you personally then, seeing it all come together?
I must say, for me, it's been a lifetime's work. It's what I've been doing for most of my career, and not made as much progress as I'd hoped until recent years. And I think for the first time, there's a bit of a light bulb moment in bringing structures and people together to actually make things work. In the past, maybe things have been a little bit too siloed. So I feel I'm ready to retire. I feel the job's done and the future leaders are there to take over.
No pressure.
Brigitte, what about you? How do you feel about it at this point?
I think, you know, it's incredibly encouraging. This is how healthcare should be working. It's about making those connections. Like Ernie says, a lot of organizations have a lot of the nuts and bolts there. It's just knowing that you can put it together, number one, and that you have got the people that are ready to put it together. And that's how you'll eventually get your Formula One pit stop sorted out. But till you know that you can do it, or you believe, you're not going to. And I think we've got enough of an encouragement from the patients and the journeys that they otherwise would have unless we keep working on this. And that's why I think the job's never done. I think we'll keep continuing to improve with that in mind. I think it's the start of a journey, but I'm proud to be on part of that journey. And I hope that we're delivering what the patients want. And I think that's the fundamental question we need to keep asking.
Yes, huge satisfaction from me. I think because similar to Ernie, although not as many years as Ernie as I've spent on this, but I was a nurse specialist in a previous life. So I've got some experience of, you know, cancer patients and some of the problems that they were experiencing around accessing urgent care. Then to sort of come through from that and then be involved in the leadership and the coordination of the urgent cancer care programme has been hugely satisfying really for me personally. As Rigit said, the job's not done. I don't think you could ever say it's ever done. We're always learning and we're always improving, and there's still lots to do. But when you look back over the last couple of years, in particular, the progress that we've made has been absolutely massive. And we just need to build on that really and share that practice nationally, you know, so that others can kind of benefit from sort of the experiences and you know, that we've had really. So, yeah, fantastic piece of work, I think, onwards and upwards.
You mentioned a number of work streams that are going on. Are there any in particular you'd like to tell us about?
So, yeah, we've got a number of work streams that are going on at the moment. We have our metastatic spinal cord compression work stream, which has really sort of just come on board, but there's been some fantastic work that's been going ahead that's being led by Clatterbridge Cancer Centre at the moment. Ernie, you're probably better pitched to sort of fill that us in on that, really.
Yeah, thanks, Mel. Yeah, so a lot of patients with cancer may develop secondary tumours in the spine, and if not recognised quickly, that can rapidly progress to nerve damage and immobilisation, which may not be reversible. And a key theme in the management of those patients is early recognition, but it's also about a coordinated response. And some of the work that's been happening as an interdependent piece of work with our programme is how best to manage that coordination. And what we're starting to see is that with that local access to tests in a prompt manner, transfer to specialists, coordination through the region, we can start to impact on patient well-being, earlier detection, and that's now showing improved survival of patients. And that's become a key feature driving recently published NICE guidance based upon some of our experience in Merseyside, which has been fantastic.
Yeah, and another work stream that we're involved in is one where not all patients will ring the hotline, because at times they will just need to present to the emergency department or will feel that that's the only way that they can present. And an example that I'm particularly talking about is where a cancer patient may have a headache, and that might actually be a secondary that's sort of in the brain, or a new tumor cancer diagnosis within the brain. And these patients historically used to have to come into hospital, have their diagnostics, have their scans, have the sort of discussions with the specialist teams. And as I was saying before, this fear that something might get missed and that if you do it as an outpatient, it might take longer, meant that you weren't able to provide a coordinated response to a patient that didn't necessarily need to stay in hospital because they could have those scans, they could have those specialist investigations, and they could be in the comfort of their own home. And that sort of culminated in the pathway that was for brain tumors. Perhaps Ernie or Mel might want to add a little bit, because there was quite a lot of work that went in coordinating that pathway.
Yeah, thanks, Raghit. Historically, these patients often are admitted to hospital, as Raghit explains, and often spend quite a long time in hospital whilst they're having that approach to investigation. But by recognising these patients at the point of entry through the emergency department, by wrapping around our coordinated offer, we can now start these patients on immediate treatment to help relieve symptoms. We can coordinate the scans. We can admit them into our virtual ward and send them home. And we can have daily coordinated oversight whilst they approached and managed by the specialist team, which is often in another hospital. And what that's allowed us is to enable a lot more patients to get home much more quickly and manage the symptoms under that daily guidance through the virtual ward.
That all sounds amazing and fantastic learning for everybody around the country, and I'm sure, in improving cancer services, in particular emergency cancer services. So thank you so much, Dr. Ernie Marshall, Dr. Raghit Varia and Mel Warwick. Thank you.
Thank
Thanks.
You.
Thank you.
Thanks again to our guests, Dr. Ernie Marshall, Dr. Raghit Varia and Mel Warwick. And if you check out the podcast notes, you'll find some useful links, including one to a case study published by NHS providers. Thank you for listening.